Hi, you're listening to The Wing Woman, brought to you by journalists and best mates, Charlie Gowans Eglinton, that's me, and Frankie Gradden, that's her. Franks, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thanks. How are you? Bathed in glorious morning sunlight.
I'm very much enjoying that even a crack of dawn recording, which we are doing today, is now in a daylight hour.
Oh.
They felt a bit shabby when they were in the darkness, didn't they?
Doesn't it make life so much better that the mornings are light and the evenings are light? 6 o'clock now, still a little whisper of daylight.
Glorious. Although I had a weird dream last night. Before I went to bed, I watched a video on The Cut. They do these Why Is Your Skin So Good videos where people share their skin routines.
Yeah.
And there's this woman who, as a preteen, she lived in Jerusalem during the Gulf War.
Mm.
So she got into the habit of wearing makeup at night so that if she was woken up in the middle of the night for an air raid, she was ready. And she still does this as a grown woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she shared her makeup routine.
Wow.
She doesn't wear foundation, but she wears eyeliner and mascara and brow gel and liquid lipstick. So then I had a really weird dream about it. I'm still sort of reeling from my very bizarre dream, which also involved me being shamed for my handwriting for some reason.
Oh man, my handwriting is diabolical. I think it's got worse in lockdown because I haven't had any need to really communicate with anybody, let alone write a letter.
I'm so used to typing now, and probably to autocorrect, but for typing every day for work, that if I try and write something by hand now, I miss out letters.
Mm.
Quite embarrassing, actually, considering what I do for a living.
I have ultimate anxiety when I have to write a card.
Yeah.
Birthday card, Christmas card, Mother's Day card. I completely forget how to write words. But also sometimes, do you find the pen moves too quickly for your brain to catch up with?
Maybe it's the pen.
Yeah.
Maybe it is the pen. Now that you've said this, I can actually see you adding an L to a word that you've skipped the L out of.
Constantly. When it's a really whizzy ballpoint, it's just run away with you and you're like, oh my God, I haven't even figured out what I'm going to say yet.
I was worried I wasn't firing on all cylinders, but I'm relieved that we have worked out it's just pens.
It's just pens.
Pens these days. Let's go back to quills.
Christ.
How are you, Franks?
I've overshare, had my first case of mastitis on my right boob.
What's that, please?
It is when your milk ducts get blocked and it's fucking painful. It goes lumpy, it goes hard, it can give you a fever. I didn't get a fever this time, thank God. But yeah, it really fucking hurts. So I've been massaging my tits in the shower.
That sounds miserable, Franks. I'm sorry.
That's all right. It's a common thing with breastfeeding.
Well.
Yeah. So that's my glamorous story to tell this morning. I'm drinking a delicious cup of Redemption Roastery coffee.
I'm drinking Redemption coffee.
Shut up, are you actually?
Yeah, I didn't know about this, and I'm guessing neither did you.
No, I didn't.
They run training programs because reoffending rates are really high with people released from prison who don't necessarily have a trade or a job to go to. And if they do have a trade or a job to go to, those rates come right down.
Yeah, so they train offenders to reintegrate into society by training them up to have barista skills. And they help their graduates find work in either their own coffee shops or with Redemption Roasters wholesale clients. So they train them and then they also provide jobs for them. And their coffee is delicious, rich, full-bodied and yummy.
And what I need after I've had a weird dream about liquid lipstick and handwriting.
There you go, exactly. Great coffee, great initiative.
Woke up to the news that remains have been found in Kent of a human body and linked to the disappearance of Sarah Everard last week. So Sarah's 33 and she was walking home from seeing friends. Oof.
I know.
And they've arrested a police officer. I think it's partly the timing of this, obviously, that there's this show on International Women's Day, which was on Monday. There's this collective celebration amongst women, I think, of what we've achieved, where women are and how much more power we have, how much more agency we have. But also the world sort of says to women on International Women's Day, oh, well, why do we even have an International Women's Day? Like, every day is International Women's Day. And then, of course, something like this that just reminds you. We've lived in London for years, and actually, I walk home at night all the time. And I used to do so when I was a student, before there were Ubers, before there were night trains, there were occasional night buses, but I used to walk all the time in the middle of the night by myself. And you do stick to the busy streets, and you wear trainers that you can run in if you need to, and you carry your keys between your fingers, and you do all of these things your mother trains you to do and that other people tell you to do. And I did used to have headphones in when I walked. If I was on a busy street, I would be listening to music. Sometimes I would take one headphone out. Sometimes I would turn the music down. I've had to go into a 24-hour news agent because someone's following me. I've had people approach me in the street. I've definitely felt scared. It just is such an everyday part of being a woman that I'd almost stopped thinking about it. And I think because at the moment we're not going out and socialising, and I'm not even going out to work, I'm not as aware of it because I am not walking home by myself at night. If I'm going for a walk, there's a million people going for a walk because everyone's out at the moment doing that. It's a reminder that that's always there for women.
Exactly. There's a great quote from Catelyn Moran. She said, "I'm 45 and it's 2021 and I am essentially under a curfew, like all women. And there are absolutely no exit plans for this. It's just presumed that women will stay home when it's dark forever." And that's exactly what it is. I agree with you. During lockdown, no one's been going out at night. So you sort of haven't been thinking about getting home and walking in the dark. But this lockdown is lifting slowly over a few months. And as of June, we are going to be going out. And girls, women are going to be walking home late at night. And we're still in the same situation. And Sarah's story has just reminded everybody that we're still so vulnerable when we go out at night, and we still have to take all of these measures. There's a piece on Grazia that has compiled loads of tweets in response to the story, and the precautions that women take, it's nuts when you think about it. Someone saying that they were taught not to wear ponytails when walking home at night because they're easy to grab. Someone saying they've been taught to walk down the middle of the street so that you're not walking past cars where people can jump out at you. The keys in between your fingers, the detours on the way home so that someone doesn't know where you live. You're right, you kind of just do it on autopilot because that's what we've been taught to, but it's just so scary that it still happens. And I think what is so upsetting is that men are surprised when women say they are nervous about walking home at night. They're nervous about being alone in the dark. Also, it's not even just in the dark. There's so many stories of women being accosted in the daytime as well. If it's an area that's not hugely public, you know, women still get flashed or verbally abused or harassed.
We used to get men flashing us on the bus to school.
Yeah.
We used to get the same single-decker bus to and from school every day. And there were a couple of men who used to sit at the back, and we'd all pile on because it was a busy town that had a lot of schools in it. It was the end of school day. And these men would just flash their bits at you. And I was 11 when that first happened. That just became the norm. And I don't know that we even...
Did you even think it was hugely unusual, or did you just think, oh, that's part and parcel?
We were a bit shaken by it every time it happened, but it happened all the time. It wasn't rare for someone to expose themselves to us as schoolgirls, and we were in big groups. I mean, we're on a bus, so it's not like we weren't safe, but I remember definitely times when we wouldn't feel safe to walk by ourselves. So it's when you get off the bus, then what if somebody gets off after you? Mm-hmm. And I remember I went to school in Kingston, and do you remember the Hammer murders?
Yeah.
We talked about it before. Anyway, that man who chased and killed women with a hammer, that was kind of in my local area. I remember how scared we all were to get off the bus and walk home after school. Mm. Not in the middle of the night, not after we'd been out drinking. Not that there's anything wrong with that, and you should be able to walk home at any time without fear that somebody's going to attack you. And you should be able to have a drink, and you shouldn't always have to be on high alert. But even then we were scared. It's built into you from such a young age, isn't it?
It is. Marisa Bate, brilliant writer, she has a newsletter called Writing About Women, and her newsletter today is about Sarah Everard, and I just want to read a passage. "It is all we've ever known, and we know it so well. Your heart beats hardest when you're alone at night, when there aren't many people in the carriage, when you feel someone is walking behind you, when you realise the road is quiet, or Google Maps has taken you to an alley. But sometimes it's there in broad daylight too, when the bloke next to you leans over at 7:20 a.m. on the Jubilee line and with thick, sweaty lips whispers, 'You have beautiful legs.' You have been warned. Don't get in a minicab. Don't drink too much. Don't be too late. Stick together. Because your mother knows the threat too. She's felt it like hot breath on skin too. She's walked home with ever quickening steps and a thumping heart too. And she knows that threat is a blanket as thick as nightfall and as constant as the tide, just like you do. And she tries to stop her worst nightmare, which will also become your worst nightmare, from becoming your reality. So your life comes with warnings, and the warnings become tragedies and headlines. And now the threat, however statistically unlikely, is real. But it's also familiar. It's all you've ever known. It is just life. It is just something women deal with, like pay gaps or being killed twice a week by a current or former partner. It is just what we know life to be, so we don't fight it. We just protect ourselves and each other. Text me when you get home." Ugh.
Text me when you get home is how you end every evening with your friends.
Yeah, always. Every time I say goodbye to you, I say, "Let me know when you get home." You say that to me as well. We always forget to do that, but I instinctively say to my female friends when I say goodbye to them and I'm not seeing them to their door, "Let me know when you get home." The amount of times you've walked me to the door.
Yeah, but we live 5 minutes apart as well. And sometimes if we've been out together and it's the evening, not even late, but it's dark. Most of the streets are busy streets that you walk on, but the most direct route, there's a lane that runs between a church and a school. And it's not long. It's a minute's walk at most. You could sprint it in 15 seconds. But the amount of times after yoga, we would, at one end of the lane, sort of watch each other so that you knew the other person was getting to the other end.
Yeah, and run down it.
Yeah, you'd run. If you were at my end of the lane, I would wait, watch from my end of the lane, and you would run so that I knew you were okay.
Yeah.
And that's nuts, isn't it? A 30-second sprint in Stoke Newington, which is an area I can't afford to buy property in. That's how gentrified it is here.
I know. It's completely nuts.
And families.
Yeah, full of posh coffee shops and giant houses. And still, the alleyway that we're talking about has got a hopscotch painted on the floor. It's next to a school playground and a church, two of the most innocent places. And yet, you shit yourself every time you have to walk down there. And the amount of times I have run down and looked over my shoulder and been terrified I'm going to see somebody, as we're talking, I can feel that feeling of realising that someone's behind you. That sick feeling and that sweaty feeling. It makes me want to cry because it's so common. In your mind, you're thinking, okay, what am I going to do? This is it. They're going to attack me from behind. What am I going to do? What have I got on me that I can protect myself with? And it's just so shit that that is a woman's reality. You know, we are meant to be free people. We are meant to be able to do what we like, but we can't. And if something does happen to us, then you get the narrative of, oh, you shouldn't have been doing that. What were you doing walking in that poorly lit area late at night? What were you doing walking home after you'd had a few drinks? You know, what were you doing walking, not being on the phone to somebody, telling them where you are? That's nuts.
A fellow journalist of ours, Phoebe McDowell, was sharing this morning on her Instagram tweets that she'd found last night, and men saying things like, "I can't believe she was walking in the dark with headphones in." And it's the, you were asking for it, it's the short skirt rape defence all over again. Mm. And how can we live our lives like that? The fact that it's it's a constant. It's every day. It's everywhere you walk. So you can never walk with headphones in.
Exactly.
I mean, so many women only jog within certain hours, and you know not to jog across a park or even along the river. A woman was accosted the other day. I read about it on social media, and she was jogging in the middle of the day along the canal, actually. Nowhere is safe. So we just stay in our own homes, and so many women aren't safe in their own homes. So where are you? It's awful.
You know, like Catelyn's tweet said, we live under a curfew, and we might have been able to forget it over the last year, maybe, because we haven't been going out, but the reality is still there. And I think what's happened to Sarah has reminded us all of that very, very sad fact. And I'm just so, so sorry for her and her family. What I also think is that Black women and Asian women go missing all the time. And I can't help but think, because she's blonde, pretty, white, middle class, it was shared all over Instagram.
I think that's definitely true. And actually, some people who had shared Sarah then went on to share the names, the faces of just a few of the other people who had gone missing the same week. Certainly looking at the social media bubble that I'm in, if I wasn't reading papers and headlines, I would have thought she was the only person to go missing. I would have thought it was an isolated incident because it was the only one people were sharing.
Yeah.
And I think you see that, don't you, with the missing persons cases, with missing children especially, the cases that stick with people, it's Madeleine McCann, isn't it? Again and again and again brought up. And I understand when evidence comes to light, that should definitely be investigated. But how many children who aren't little blonde white girls are getting the same amount of police manpower, are getting the same amount of headlines, are getting the same amount of publicity and calls for people to come forward if they have news? Over years and years now, so much time and airspace has been given to Madeleine McCann. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but it should be to every child, not just the little blonde, blue-eyed girls.
Exactly. Well, it's the same. It's Millie Dowler, Amanda Kircher, and quite rightly so, we should be talking about these people. But yes, we should be talking about these other people as well, who go missing all the time, who get attacked all the time.
It shouldn't just be people who look like us. Someone shouldn't have to have my skin tone for me to care that they've gone missing. It's mad, isn't it? Because when you look at this importance given to a case like Sarah's, and you look at so many cases that are overlooked and that we never hear about, actually.
Oh, they don't even make it into mainstream media.
No.
They're not given the airtime at all. I think this story has really highlighted that that is still very much the case.
Speaking of racism, should we jump to Meghan Markle?
So we're recording this on Thursday morning. What do we know so far? Meghan and Harry sat down with Oprah and did their tell-all interview. That was on Sunday, aired over in the UK on Monday. The palace has released a statement, brief statement. Piers Morgan has been, well, not reading very deeply between the lines, sacked from Good Morning Britain for his comments over not believing Meghan.
We should say the party line is that he resigned and they accepted that without issue.
Sure.
Or something.
Yeah.
Don't sue us.
And the internet has collectively exploded with comment pieces, opinion pieces over mainly Meghan and do we believe her? Has she ruined the royal family? Etc.
You would think from the coverage of the headlines that Prince Harry was locked in a cavern, or a four-year-old child that she has taken charge of who isn't able to speak for themselves. Because you wouldn't think that an actual member of the royal family, born into the royal family, was also taking this line and was also saying these things, because that is not the coverage. It's Meghan, apparently.
I mean, my feelings are... What are my feelings?
What are your feelings?
I don't care hugely about the royal family, as in I'm not hugely interested in the royal family. I think we will never know the details of what has gone on in this situation. But what we do know for sure is how Meghan has been treated by the media and by public opinion. We've all seen the headlines before any of this happened, just when we knew that her and Harry were dating, when the announcement of the engagement was made, when the wedding was made. You know, yes, there was this layer of excitement and joy that Harry had found someone he wanted to make his wife, and there was going to be this fairy tale wedding. But, you know, not too far under the surface was a hell of a lot of racist comments and headlines, a hell of a lot of comments alluding to her being some sort of gold digger, headlines mentioning her age, that she was, you know, somehow older than what was expected, that she was a divorcee, that she was American, that she was an actress, basically making out that she wasn't suitable to be a future princess.
But from the beginning, racist headlines. From the beginning, straight out of Compton. From the beginning, questions about what their children were going to look like. I remember these headlines. I mean, we work in the media, and yes, we predominantly write about fashion, certainly at that time we were. But I remember being shocked by headlines. I remember being shocked by comment pieces that talked about a descendant of slavery being part of the royal family.
Yeah.
That were racist, that tried to hide racism beneath, this will be completely new for the royal family, and obviously we're very pro-diversity, but then would go on really racist rants. And actually, I've been seeing on social media over the past couple of days, those headlines next to each other will be, Kate cradles her bump on her last royal engagement. And then the same headline for Meghan will be, why can't she stop touching her bump? The fact that she wasn't allowed to touch her pregnant stomach because people thought it was too performative is really bizarre.
Yeah, she couldn't really win from the get-go. I mean, this is another issue within all of this. You know, the media loves to pit women against women, but the pitting of Meghan against Kate and those headlines, they're just ridiculous. In the interview, the one about the avocado was mentioned, apparently it's a remedy for morning sickness, and when Kate took it, it was like, oh, you know, brilliant, she's taking it for her morning sickness. When Meghan took it, she was somehow contributing to deforestation and climate change and was the spawn of the devil, pretty much. From early on, you got the feeling that Meghan could not win in the media's eyes and in the public's eyes, by and large. And I think since this interview has aired, the reaction has been so telling of how we regard her, how we regard women who speak their mind, who are self-assured, all those things that we say as a society we want women to be. When someone then is that, it becomes a problem.
So I wrote about Meghan and why I believe her and the trope of the difficult woman for the Times on Tuesday. And it is that what you could see looking back at her first arrival, looking back at when the media turned on her, the different points, you know, they were so angry. Yes, when she wouldn't give that hospital steps picture that Kate always gives in a pretty floral dress with a blow dry, that Meghan didn't choose to do that hours after having a baby, that is apparently our right as the public, that we deserve that. So many things that the media started to turn on her for, and they used to tally up. There was always an interest in how much her clothes cost. There was always an interest in how much she was spending and whether she was difficult and whether she was too outspoken. And actually, I think as soon as she started speaking, that was a huge problem. I think there was definitely racism right from the start, but that gave the media their excuse. As soon as she started speaking, they could say she was too outspoken and a royal shouldn't offer an opinion on this and that. And a royal shouldn't outwardly say that they're a feminist or that they support women. I mean, shocking things. But for me, and I think for so many women, you can recognise it yourself, because the difficult woman is something that we all have levied at us from childhood. At school, if you want to take the lead in a group project, you're bossy. And a boy is never called bossy. A boy is never called pushy. You know, they're called cheeky or, oh, he's really confident. But I was never called confident at school. That wasn't the word for me.
Mm.
And actually, when women at work are just focused on work and maybe don't want to get into tea breaks and coming to these drinks and doing this and that, they're a bitch. Whereas for men, you're allowed to be whatever you want, and there's a reason why that's a good thing. And for women, and certainly for Megan, you quickly came to the realization that for the media, at least, and potentially for the palace, there is a right kind of woman, and that woman is white. She is virginal. She's certainly not divorced or in her 30s, God forbid.
Yeah.
And she is not at all outspoken. She doesn't share her opinions. And Meghan was none of those things. So society wanted to tear her down. And I think what's particularly shocking about this interview is she talks about her mental health and she talks about suicidal thoughts. She's incredibly open. And the response to that has been shocking. And Matt Haig actually shared on social media, if someone has a heart attack, you don't check if you like them before getting help. Stop treating mental illness like a popularity contest. You don't have to like someone in order to not belittle their health. It's shocking that because mental health doesn't necessarily have a physical manifestation, that without having ever met her or having been there for any of this, people feel just from reading headlines that they are in a position to comment and say, I don't believe her. I don't believe she felt suicidal. I don't believe she felt like that. I think she's making it all up. I can't believe that is the response, honestly.
But also, sadly, I kind of was expecting the media to say, ugh, no, she just wants to get the headlines. You know, she's attention seeking to make more money, which is really sad. But this comes back to something that you said, actually. I can't remember if it was last podcast or the podcast before, but we say as a society, we are open to discussions about mental health and we support conversations about mental health and we are open about it, we're receptive to it, we understand it. And yet, someone in the public eye is saying, I was really struggling, I had thoughts about killing myself. And we immediately jump to, no, you didn't. We don't believe you. Which is so damaging, because to have an issue and to be open about it and to talk about it, that's a major barrier that's been broken down. And the whole issue with mental health in this country, certainly, is that we don't talk about it. It is something that we have swept under the carpet and sort of not really believed it's there. And in the last few years, it has felt so positive that these conversations have started to happen, and it's been so evident that actually it affects a huge amount of people. So for then to someone to put their hand up and say, hi, I was really struggling, to have this huge reaction of disbelief and to try and shut it down, to villainize this person, I think puts us back so many steps. And I think that is utterly, utterly sad.
And all the people watching who were trying to work up the courage to open up to someone about how they're feeling, or who have felt that way and never told anyone, all those people watching, the message for them loud and clear is no one will believe you.
Yeah.
I think so often people are only willing to believe that you might have struggled with something if they can see a reason why you should have, which is bizarre. And actually, when I wrote that piece about posing for those new portraits and the new photo, I was writing about my own body hang-ups and what I was ashamed of in my body and what I hated in my body. And the comments on that, I mean, I got a lot of encouragement, which is brilliant, and a lot of support. But I got a lot of men who would either say, having looked at the pictures, didn't need to see this after I'd had my lunch. I either got those, like, you're not attractive enough to have these pictures taken.
Oh, God.
Or I got, you're not unattractive enough to have felt this way. You're not unattractive enough to hate something about yourself, I don't believe you.
Yeah.
And I wonder if people look at Meghan and they think, well, she's got money.
Mm.
She's got fame and success.
Mm-hmm.
She's happily married. She's very beautiful. She's got a family. So what right does she have?
Yeah.
And unless your life is completely falling apart, people don't feel that you have a right to mental health issues.
Mm.
Not that I'm saying, you know, that mine is in any way comparable, but it is just that if I don't look at you and think your life is shit, then you are not allowed to feel shit about yourself.
Yeah. Which is so problematic because we know that mental health doesn't work that way.
No, of course not.
And I think people do look at Meghan and see all of that and are angered by it and think, what right does she have to complain? I think also what's interesting is so many people have picked up on when she was talking to Oprah. She's incredibly eloquent. She's American, so she has a different way of talking than the Brits.
She's a trained actress, and that means she's trained to give speeches. She will have worked with speech teams when she's delivered a talk, probably.
Yes.
At the British Fashion Awards or when she's spoken in front of a group of people. She might have had professional training for that, or she might have just had the experience of doing that and giving interviews that hones that as a skill.
Yes, and she will make an analogy about The Little Mermaid, and there's almost a poetry there to how she speaks and how she expresses herself, how she communicates. And I think the British public struggle with that, because what we want is Harry sitting next to her, stumbling over his words, turning red in the face. We want that almost apologetic British sensibility when you are saying, something's happened and I need help. We won't allow someone to be able to communicate themselves well and eloquently. We then think, well, then that must be fake.
Yeah, people read polished as scripted.
As rehearsed, exactly.
As if she's acting. But if you were going on an interview with Oprah, would you not think about what you wanted to get across in that interview? If you're doing a tell-all of why I blew my life up and my husband's life up and made an enemy of loads of people and gave up my whole life in America and have now given up my whole life in Britain, would you not give some advanced thought to what you were going to say?
Exactly.
I certainly would. I wouldn't go into it cold and then answer all questions with, God, you know, I hadn't really thought about that. Would you?
No, I know. I mean, I really feel for them. I really feel for them. I think this must be such a sad situation. I think Meghan has been through the absolute ringer with the British press. I don't know what's going on with their family, but there is so much there that we will not ever know. I think at the basics, here's a family. And, you know, I know they're the monarchy. I know they're the institution, but they're also people and they're a family. And at the basics, here's a family who's broken, which I think is incredibly sad. And I'm so sorry that a portion of that family is now having to live halfway across the world and is not in regular and pleasant communication with each other. But I just feel so sad that a woman who did not fit into the mould of what we wanted has been treated so poorly. And I think also it's worth remembering, you know, we now look at Kate as the perfect princess. But what you picked up in your piece, when she was first revealed to be William's girlfriend, future wife, potential future queen, she was subject to all sorts of awful comments.
Oh, yeah. The press was full of comments about her not being aristocratic, about her class, about her mother having worked as cabin crew. I mean, the pictures of that sheer dress that she wore at university, where you could see her knickers underneath.
When you say Kate Middleton, I think of that picture because I've seen it that many times.
It was the only picture that was used for, I would say, all of their dating life.
Yeah.
And when they broke up, you just saw that dress every time. Just her in a semi-sheer dress that she wore at a university fashion show. She was constantly shamed. And in my piece, actually, another journalist had quoted a source at Buckingham Palace who said that, and I'm paraphrasing, people were quite snobby to Kate when she first arrived, but she kept her head down and got on with it. And what I read from that is that she had to endure some level of hazing or bullying and being made to feel common and small. She just had to put up with that until people accepted her. No one should have to put up with that. And yes, I think Meghan had it far worse, because partly of the Wallis Simpson thing of divorcee and she's older, so obviously she's, you know, seducing him, but a lot to do with her race. But even so, no one should have to endure that. That shouldn't be the culture. That shouldn't be how our press reports on women, say two members of the press. God, it's going to make for a very compelling season of The Crown, isn't it?
I know.
Might tune back in. Franks, what are your recommendations for me this week?
So, my first recommendation is a podcast.
Is it this one?
It's this one.
It is good, but if they're listening to your recommendations, they've already found it. But I do believe we should toot our own horn.
I think we should as well. But I'm going to toot someone else's horn. Toot, toot.
Okay.
It's called Millennial Love, and it's hosted by Olivia Petter, and it's actually a independent podcast, as in it's by The Independent. Do you know what I mean?
Not independent in the way that we are, as in very low-key set up laptops on coffee tables.
This one is from The Independent newspaper. The whole series is about, as the title says, millennial love, and exploring all the different issues with that, all the different experiences with that. But one of the most recent episodes is with Nell Frissell. Poor Nell. I'd been calling her Nell Frissell for ages. It's not. It's Nell Frissell. She's written a book called The Panic Years, which sounds absolutely brilliant. I've actually downloaded it on Audible. Did that last night after listening to this podcast episode. So it's a memoir, and it explores her time in her late 20s when she sort of came up for air from the chaos of her early 20s and suddenly thought, holy shit, my life isn't on the trajectory that I want it to be. If I want to achieve X, Y, and Z, I need to make some radical changes. For her, it meant coming out of a relationship which she liked very much. She loved her partner very much, but he ultimately was not the person that she wanted to have children with. And that was her, or one of her goals for her 30s was to build a family. So she talks about that decision and explores that in the book. But in the podcast, she talks about how the panic years might be breaking up with a partner, but it also might be coming out of a job that is dead end or not the career that you want to have. It might be realizing that you're living somewhere that you don't want to live. You know, you might want to live halfway across the world, or you might be halfway across the world and you want to come back home, you know, whatever. It's that sort of time period where you just kind of have to blow your life up in order to, this is a horrible phrase, but get your ducks in a row. And I really identified with that. I really remember having that moment sort of 27, 28, where I just thought, oh my God, in a minute, I'm going to be 30. And society tells me at 30 or in my 30s, I need to have my shit together. So how am I going to make this leap from binge drinking in the pub every night after doing a day's work in a job that I find horribly stressful and not having enough clean knickers to wear the next morning, to then somehow, you know, being this fully functioning, responsible woman? And I know so many women particularly who have gone through this time period. So I thought the concept was incredibly spot on. I want to quote something she said in the podcast, which alludes to this panic here. And I just thought, it could have been from my head. In my 20s, I felt in order to operate, quote unquote, successfully in a heterosexual cisgendered world, I had to be magically, silently infertile, casual, romantically disinterested, and commitment phobic, if at all possible. And then almost the moment I switched over into my 30s, I was expected to be magically invisible and uncomplainingly fertile. People around me were having babies, and I was expected to just be in that camp already. I was expected to be committed, sensible, loving, caring. And I remember thinking, you can't do that in a year. And it just so speaks to that flick of a switch that women are expected to metamorphosize from the fun, career-driven woman that men are happy to fall into a relationship with because kids aren't on the horizon, there's no pressure, it's all fun and sex and mini breaks, to then suddenly become the earth mother.
Nurturer.
Nurturer is the word I'm looking for, exactly. And if you don't do that, men look at you like, what's wrong with you? And society makes you feel like you're falling behind. Do you know what I mean?
Oh God, I really know what you mean.
Sorry, I'm sort of almost shouting this because I feel that bothered by how it is for women. So sorry if I've gone a bit shouty.
I completely know what you mean. And now for me, as a woman of 33, who is still very career focused, who is still single, not so much the sort of party and wild dating, certainly in lockdown, but let's be honest, even before that, I'm constantly aware, I'm constantly slightly panicked that I'm running out of time, that I'm in the wrong phase, that I've misstepped, because you suddenly fall out of sync with your friends. And, you know, over the last year, to have you and to have Sophie both have your babies, I do sometimes think, am I leaving it too late? Is this going to happen for me? Am I going to meet someone? Should I be dedicating this much time to my career? Should I be thinking this much about my career? And then feeling selfish and perhaps unusual for being so invested in my career still, because I'm not in that phase anymore. And I'm now supposed to have just started nurturing.
Exactly. And building a home.
But I'm accidentally only nurturing myself.
And quite right too. But to the sort of motherhood point, there was another brilliant point that she raised, that there's no right time in our society for women to have children. Or perhaps there is, but it is like a slither of time. Basically, what, 31, 32 is when you're allowed to have children? Because then if you get too old, you're constantly told that you're getting too old. You might miss the boat.
Well, and you're a geriatric pregnancy.
Exactly. How insulting is that? But if you're too young, there's a lot of stigma that's attached to that as well. And Nell talks about how she feels like you're made as a woman to feel like if you get pregnant in your early 20s and you then aren't able to climb the career ladder in the way that you would if you perhaps didn't have children, you've then somehow failed feminism, because feminism isn't having kids and staying at home and doing domestic duties. It is being a girl boss, the worst phrase ever, but you know, it's going out and forging a career and banging on the glass ceiling in that way, etc. So you're kind of only allowed to do things in a specific order, which sucks.
Does suck.
This is turning out to be the cheeriest of podcasts, Chance, isn't it, Jess? And I'm so sorry, this next recommendation is also kind of stressful, but I found hugely enjoyable. It's a TV show. I'm going to say now, it's not one for you, Charlie Gowans.
Okay.
Don't watch this. If, like Charlie, you need your TV to be a comfort blanket, if you need it to be nostalgic and soothing, do not listen to what I'm about to say.
God, it's not Poirot, is it?
Years and years on iPlayer. Oh my God. This was released in 2019. I completely missed it and I've only just watched it.
What is it?
It's by Russell T Davies. So the same person that wrote It's a Sin. And I watched It's a Sin and I thought it was just the most brilliant thing I've watched on TV in forever. So then decided I wanted to watch Years and Years. It's set in 2019 and it basically imagines the next 15 years, but with a apocalyptic overtone.
Spot on then.
Yeah, it's got that weird, freaky Black Mirror vibe where it's so close to reality, but it's also completely terrifying and catastrophic that it's unimaginable that it would happen, but it could so easily happen. And I took away from it, if we continue to do what we are doing, the shit's going to hit the fan. Arguably, the shit is already hitting the fan. There's quite a lot of shit just hitting the fan and flying all over the place.
It's just so many shits and so many fans.
But it's really, really entertaining and very well done. There's a really sinister sort of soundtrack. Well, it's not a soundtrack, it's this one song that keeps playing, and it is fucking freaky. It has Lydia West in it, who plays Jill in It's a Sin, who I've completely fallen in love with. I think she's absolutely brilliant. It's got Russell Tovey in it, it's got Jessica Hines in it, it's got a really great cast, and it's just fantastic, but it is a little bit stressful. So if you need comfort TV, don't watch it. If you're like our friend Rachel, who has been spending lockdown watching disaster films because it makes her reality feel like less of a shit show, then try it.
Do you know what my main takeaway from that is? What do you think would happen if shit hit a Dyson fan? Because they don't have the blades, but then the blow is a very strong blow compared. So do you think it would just like hover in midair and then change direction? Like a boomerang.
Propelled across the room, maybe.
So if anybody tries that, do let us know.
You're so weird.
You could try it with something else. I mean, you could try it with shit, but maybe like a mozzarella. Is that too formed? Anyway.
What are your recommendations?
Shall I give you mine?
Yes, please.
So the first one is almost going somewhere, but it's not quite. So Open House London, which is an event that opens up different homes and different architectural gems across London each year, is doing a Zoom series. So tickets are £3, and for that you get the link to watch the live streamed house tour. So on March 24th, you can get a tour of Vanbrugh Park Estate, which was built in 1963 by Chamberlain, Powell and Bond, who were the architects who built the Barbican and the Golden Lane Estates.
Oh, fun!
Yeah, so the Vanbrugh Park Estate is on the edge of Greenwich Park in London, and they will be touring two different properties on that estate. So you get to see how people live, which I love a house tour, but also really interesting architecturally.
Yeah.
If you are interested in mid-century architecture, brutalist architecture, I will be watching. And my second, so the last theatre gig style event that I went to before lockdown, that Frankie also went to, was Letters Live.
I loved that.
Which we absolutely loved. It was at the Union Chapel in Islington. And once they start doing live shows again, I am there like a shot. So they get lots of actors, journalists, authors, singers to read out letters from the past. All sorts of different letters. Some are love letters, some are incredibly moving, some are funny and short. It's brilliant. And in honour of International Women's Day, they have put an hour-long video of a show together that you can watch on YouTube. We'll put the link in our show notes, but it's only on until Monday the 15th of March. So I have my fingers crossed that you're listening to this the first weekend we come out. If you're not, I'm sorry. And we'll keep you posted with anything coming up from Letters Live, because it is brilliant. But it has readings from Olivia Colman, Adwoa Boa, Gillian Anderson, Catlin Moran. And yes, it means watching something on your screen, but I would highly recommend it.
The letter that sticks with me from when we went to see it is the one that Sue Perkins wrote about her dog Pickle.
Oh,
do you remember?
Yeah, it's a really great one.
A love letter to her dog who had died. Oh, you can find it on the internet. It is fantastic. Pickle. Thanks, Chazzy. They were lovely recommendations.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you. I'm exhausted, babe. I feel like I have talked your ear off.
Well, shall we wrap things up?
Let's wrap things up. Thank you so much for listening. It's been an absolute treat. If you like what you've heard, please do rate, review, subscribe, and do tell your friends.
You can also find us in written form at thewingwoman.co.uk, where you can sign up for our free fortnightly newsletter.
And you can follow us on Instagram at Charlie Gowans, at Frankie Gradden, collectively at thewingwoman_, or drop us an email at thewingwomanofficial@gmail.com. Perfect.
Thanks for listening.
Have a lovely day, everyone. Ta-ra.
Bye.